I'm Lisa Anita Wagner.
And I am Lisa McEwen.
And together we are She's Gotta Have It. I love Dick, episode 2.
Welcome to episode 2. Well, our third episode.
Episode 2 of...
Yeah, I love Dick.
Did we want to start by you reading the summation again?
Yes. So, I Love Dick, episode 2, is called The Conceptual Fuck. Okay, this is way too long a synopsis. Oh my god. Okay, this is way too short a synopsis. I feel like the synopsis Goldilocks. I can't find a synopsis that I'm satisfied with, so let's just do a quick roundup, which is that we open with a visual of Chris Krause's film, and a couple of Italian men are watching it. And then we move to Chris and Silver having sex. And then when they get dressed and she declares that she's going to go and sit in on Audit Dick seminar. Silver goes to...
I think there was a meeting of all the fellows.
Mm.
And
okay.
Because that's when Toby said, oh, like, is this meeting mandatory every week?
Right. Yeah. Oh, my God. The look that they gave her.
I do find her character perfect with that total stony face. And yeah. She's kind of over everything.
And then... Chris goes back to her apartment to find Devin fixing the fridge, and Devin declares that she's writing a script. I think that's like about it. And Sylvia comes back and tries to seduce Chris again, but she...
Oh, right, like in that, he was kind of... Yeah, it seemed like he was put off because of the interaction with him and Toby.
Yes, yeah.
Which we'll definitely talk about.
Oh, we're definitely going to talk about that. Okay, so that is a very concise synopsis. I mean, it was an interesting episode because not a lot happened
in it.
Yeah.
Well, in the whole I Love Dick, really, not a lot happens, but so much happens.
Do you know what we forgot? We forgot our opening segment of...
What do we want?
What we want, yeah.
What we want.
I have not prepared in advance for this at all, so...
I feel like I know right now. What I want this week is time to enjoy myself. I've been working a lot and kind of, just been at a little past maximum for a while, and I'm really, like, craving a series of 3 days or something where I don't have to do a lot to really unwind and to silence my mind. That is my want right now. And a hamburger, but we just ate one, and I ate one right before dinner yesterday.
Amazing. Yeah, I think we're kind of on the same page this week because I just handed in three drafts of chapters to one of my advisors, and I'm flying to New York this week to have a meeting with him. I kind of am at that point with my work where I'm so close to it that I am so overwhelmed and have no perspective on it. And I just feel like I've been a little wound up this weekend. So I would like to just unwind this week and enjoy, you know, actually not having to work on this for a little while. And enjoy going to New York and seeing some of my buddies there because I haven't been there in about a year.
So wow, a year. Lovely.
I'm excited. I don't like living in New York. I do like visiting New York. It is a very fun town to visit. The town of 10 million people. So it should be good times.
Excellent. Yeah. I've been so busy also because I'm working on some performances, which are really cool. And I am sad that you're going to be in New York during my next performance.
I know.
You're such a jet setter. but it's lovely to be tired from doing work that you love.
Yeah.
Like that, I got to say, is pretty great.
Definitely. Definitely.
Excellent. Good check-in of what we want right now.
Yeah. Initial impressions.
Cringy discomfort of Chris Krause, which I now really love, is sort of just starting to, like, get to the climaxing area where it's still going to even get, you know, more. But it is, I guess what I feel like it's now seeing it multiple times... it is like a sort of crescendo of this clusterfuck that is Chris Krause. And I guess from someone who's been told my whole life that I was like too much, it's kind of like a crescendo of too muchedness.
Yeah.
And I really, yeah, that's one thing that just really strikes me.
Yeah, I think I felt that most intensely with the scene where she barges into his class and is, just like everything is very quiet. It is a very masculine space because it is like very, I find, like kind of looks like a barn, and there's a lot of brick and there's a lot of dark wood and there's a lot of thick solid wood.
Big metal doors.
Lots of straight lines.
What was that line that Dick says? A straight line is perfection, I think.
Yeah, I wrote it down. I love a straight line. A straight line is perfection. Yeah.
Dick.
And just she drops things and her cell phone's ringing
that is really a glorious version of that. And even the fact that she opens up her laptop, there's a table like right next to where they are, which would be a good place to put it. And she crouches on the floor in like kind of like a grasshopper position.
Yeah.
And then puts it on the floor, which makes him need to come down. So like you couldn't create more awkwardness.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I definitely noticed that the floor option was awkward, but I hadn't thought about the table.
The table, like it's that big bank table in the gallery, and you see it in the shot. It's literally right next to it. For me, that's when someone makes decisions like that, it's just the shows that she's in such a place of like that. Yeah, of a really like bizarre decision making because she's so kind of out of herself.
Yeah.
And then again, it's not cute. And then she's like, oh, let me brighten it. Like just making the most awkward possible moment to show someone your work.
Yeah. And, really conveys, I think, her desperation.
Yes.
I don't quite look like the way she does anymore, but I think sometimes on the inside, I still feel this kind of like desperate need for validation from people like my advisors. So in a small way, I kind of relate to it, but I also find myself in such agony watching her because her desperation is so like, she's just like vomiting it everywhere. And it is chaotic and flaily and yeah, very kind of loud and messy.
And then too, I think she declared this already in the first two, but it sort of seems like there's this anger where she's like, I'm going to, like, I think it was in the first one where they're going out and Sylvia's like, no, let's not go, let's just go home. And she's like, I'm going to go make him as uncomfortable as I can. So there's this like kind of anger and like rage behind it as well, this desperation. So it's very multifaceted. I'd mentioned this before, I think, but the first time I watched it before I really understood what this piece was doing and why it was like that, I was really confused by the character of Chris Krauss because I found her unappealing at first. Not that that's not there, but I didn't like understand the gloriousness of what was going on. The desperation plus the anger, which I think is a very real state of being that I'm really interested in things I haven't seen a million times. I haven't seen that a lot.
Yeah.
And also in that particular way. I think in terms of that's a big check mark of like for me of something I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
So yeah, like a female character that's allowed to be that kind of angry and aggressive and a mess.
And it also seems like she, I don't quite know how to phrase this thought, but it's like she's demanding to be seen. But again, to go back to the distinction that I brought up last time that has been made by John Berger, which is the difference between like the kind of the nudity and the nakedness, the way that nudity portrays women in a certain kind of acceptable, beautiful, submissive, you know, taking up a certain amount of space and no more kind of way. She seems to be like really trying to be seen for who she is. And I think that is actually a kind of like interesting kind of personification of somebody trying to kind of beat against the door of the male gaze, right? That's sort of, because that is absolutely what Dick represents in all of his very hilarious masculinity.
Women can't make films from behind their oppression. Summer films. That's Dick, not me, clearly.
What did he say? Did he say it's like boring? Or it's too sad?
Did he say it's makes for bummer films?
Yes, that's
it's
right.
A bummer, right? Which yeah. is like so funny.
Which is, yeah.
And yeah, as well as being seen, I also feel like she's driving her own story no matter what. She's mm-hmm. the heroine of her own story no matter what. Which I think is, I guess, part of being seen. Like that's sort of what, yeah. in being seen, that's what you're putting forth.
Yeah, but she is kind of going about it in this very, yeah, aggressive and in some ways like childlike way. Like it's very...
emotional. I think it's an emotional path, yeah. not a logical or linear path.
Yeah.
And there's no things you have to like win or get right. You can like not pay your musicians. You can make a bad film. Yeah. You can like be super embarrassing and walk weird and put your computer on the floor and you still can, it's still your story. So yeah. that's the thing that I like about it too. There's not these things that you have to reach, these goals that have to happen. Yeah. I think it's an emotional storyline.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think of that before.
Yeah, that kind of ties into, like, I'm not really sure, like, within our segments when to bring this up, but I'm just going to go for it, mm-hmm. because why not? It's anarchy here at the House of Data. Sorry, you just took a drink of water and then I made you laugh. I feel like maybe this belongs in the male gaze section. We could just sort of shift into that if you were sure. good with that. All right, our next segment, listeners, is called That's What He Said, which is our segment on thinking about the male gaze, which, you know, Kevin Bacon to me seems to represent, and also so does his line, I love a straight line. Straight line is perfection, right? Like, it's about having this kind of, like, control and order, and also the way that masculinity is also often represented with straight lines, and femininity is also usually associated with curviness.
Curves, yeah.
And just the fact that, like, I think that, like, ties in nicely with the point you just made, which is, yeah, like, it's not, like, A to B to C. There's a clear kind of path. You know, we don't have, like, Joseph Campbell's, like, the hero's journey kind of, like, formulated in front of us. But instead, she is literally just, like,
stumbling
kind of...
in an erratic shape around Marfa.
Stumbling in an erratic shape. Yes, that is exactly the nature of this narrative. Which also, I think, hilariously ties in with when he's at the end and he sees the snake. And just the way he's looking at this snake, which is, like, curving around. And the snake, which I have learned from one of my favorite podcasts, Which Please, in which they talked about the way that snakes represent the chthonic or earthly, like, kind of womanly magic.
Hmm.
So snakes are historically kind of associated with the feminine and... in lots of kind of different ways. And the way that, like, he's initially just kind of staring at the snake, kind of in the same way that he stares at her.
Yeah.
When she stumbles in and just, like, Kevin Bacon is so perfect in his just, like, he's just standing there. He is a straight line because he is very tall and skinny. And he is standing there just looking at her.
Just, like, taking it in. Yeah, and he's looking at her like it does not compute.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost. Like, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly... And so when he's looking at the snake, like, I felt like he was kind of annoyed looking at the snake. And then it was interesting because then, you know, one of the next scenes, and this is one of the last scenes of the episode, he's creating a kind of, like, rock...
Oh, snake!
A rock snake.
That he jogs next to.
He jogs next to. Because it's, like, for the first time in his life, Dick is trying to figure out something that is not a straight
curvy.
Line.
You know, I've watched that so many times. Yeah. I truly got some kind of weird pleasure out of watching him jog next to the... Because he looks so pleased with himself with that little jog. And he's like, no, it's complete.
Yeah.
So that moment bemused me, but it didn't dawn on me. Yeah, all of his work is so super straight. Yeah, and everything he says is just like a statement. Like, this is fact. This is fact. Lines are beautiful. They are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I am a line, too.
And so it seems like... We don't get, this is what's infuriating, but also I think useful about Dick, is we don't really see, I mean, other than the things he tells us, like he finds female filmmakers boring or a bummer or whatever. It's sometimes hard, he's a little bit inscrutable. It's sometimes hard to tell, like, yeah, because he's looking at her and he's, like, taking it in and he's, he's confused, but it's almost like he's sort of like vaguely annoyed slash trying to figure it out or make sense of it.
And yeah, it's interesting. Later on in an episode, someone calls him like the unknowable cowboy. I think that's so true. Like, he is unknowable. He's crafted himself with this unknowable persona.
Yeah. And so, but like, that's the only explanation I have for like why he isn't like sending her away immediately. Because I feel like if he wanted to, he could, like, I don't know, maybe this is maybe just more of a question. Like, do you think he could just get rid of her if he like really wanted to? Or do you think he just kind of...
I think he could. I feel like he was sort of, looked like he was heading that way. But then remember when he started reading the letters, he's like rolling his cigarettes. Like he's getting ready to look at porn.
That's true.
I do think it's true when he's saying, I'm not interested in you. I don't like your art. Like, I believe that is his truth, but I think there's still something. And he says, and also in a later episode, that it's humiliating, but he's still drawn. And I think it's because it's new for him. Like, he does seem like he's someone that's a little bit blasé and bored with his awesome artist life.
Yeah. Yes, and also maybe the kind of posturing that artists do kind of around him to be kind of something, like, appropriate or, like, you know.
But I think if he really wanted her gone, he could have done something. So I do feel like there's still, like, he was definitely, like, making gestures, like, go, I gotta get rid of that wife, gotta go. But, yeah, I feel like there was something in him that was still at least interested, intrigued, fascinated, confused.
Yeah.
Like looking at the snake. Yeah, because there was a reference to snakes in the very first episode too, with the shoes that she had on. So it does seem like the snake is just kind of popped up.
Yeah. Okay, like, I think like a lot of this actually falls into the male gaze for me. So I'm also just going to ask you what you thought of the opening sequence where there's the two Italian guys from Cannes? Is that the film festival that she...
Venice. The Venice Film Festival.
The Venetian Film Festival. That makes more sense why it would be Italian men.
And yeah, I commented right after we watched it, but I think as a filmmaker who has sent a lot of my work to film festivals, it was kind of that perfect comical version of a nightmare that we've all had of someone watching our film and then kind of like belittling and be like, what's the Chris Krause? What is this?
Yeah.
And so that was really interesting. And then I found it interesting because in a way you can't disagree with them, but they said it in such a like awful, condescending way. So yeah, I think it was just, again, a scene I haven't seen before, especially because, you know, often in film, there'll be someone saying something and you don't agree with them, but I just kind of agree with them. If I was a programmer, I wouldn't use her films either. Mm-hmm. But then that is more of the, again, just the male gaze imposing that as well. Mm-hmm. And it was just genuinely funny as a filmmaker because I was like, oh my God, that's the actual, that's, you know, the classic, like, naked on stage filmmaker, like programmers, like laughing, like throw it over there. But that's just what comes to mind. What are your thoughts?
It wasn't a scene I'd like thought very much about, in part because the very first time I watched it, my version does not include subtitles. And so I had a sense of what they were saying, but this time I was like able to understand more specifically what they were saying. And it's hard to deny their verdict of it, but you're right that there's something in the way that they do it that is very condescending. And so I think both of those are true. Like, I wasn't super happy with them, but I was also like, you're not wrong.
Yeah, and then even just the accent and the name, like, Chris Krause. But yeah, and then again, I love art film so much, but I sort of have that same thing where you love it and there is also so much of it that is so bad or misguided or all different things. So it's interesting to love a medium so much, but also, you know, be so wary of it at the same time. So yeah, but it is interesting that that was the very first scene. And then there was them dancing naked and then the credits started. Is that right? At the beginning of it?
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah. Then they were dancing naked and then they were fucking, but I can't remember when the credits started. I think you're right that the fucking comes after the credits.
Yeah, because I think, again, it's like the story's shaping up being like these guys would be like, oh yeah, she's not a filmmaker, there's nothing, she's not, it's not an artist, nothing here. I remember actually Jill Soloway saying once she thought that that actress Catherine Hahn, who plays Chris Krause, was like a physical comedian genius like Charlie Chaplin. And today, in the fact of that, you know, taking the computer to the ground to awkwardly show the piece, and also when she walks into the gallery to see Dick, she just had this really wonderful way of walking where she just showed her discomfort through every pore of her body. Oh, just so back to the we just talked about the very first moment where the two film critics kind of dissed her. And again, that interesting reality of like, can't disagree with them, but ow, but mean. And then she's dancing wild, sensuous, but awkward way with Silvaire. And it kind of, she's like, yeah, right away, just taking her story back. And she's constantly making herself, the heroine or the center of her own story. Because it did seem like they literally threw her film, like the CD, like over just sort of into the corner.
Yeah.
And then she's like, here I am dancing naked and dancing to that klezmer bossa nova smash song they keep referencing to that she didn't pay for. And the song really is catchy. Like every time I watch it, it's in my head right now. Although there's no way I can get it out at all because it's all like... singing I can't do. But yeah, I hadn't thought of that before you asked, but that's what I think's interesting about that opening scene and then the reclaiming it.
It is interesting the way it goes from like kind of nightmare vision to suddenly this weird fantasy too, right? Where like, I mean, there's the dancing, but then there's also they're fucking and she's imagining Dick watching them.
And then she said that they turned their house into a brothel because they started having so much sex.
Okay, so I want to come back to that in a minute, but there's one more thing I want to talk about in the male gaze section, which is the amazing Toby and Silvaire scene.
Oh yes.
Oh my god.
Well, I'm so fascinated. She is such a like a privileged white feminist, and then her work I really think is very interesting.
Denies that her work is feminist.
Yeah,
which is like a thing I did when I was 20, by the way. Like that. Oh yeah, it's like. I did not declare myself a feminist until way later than is...
I did at the beginning of this podcast.
All right, yeah, so listeners, I think I was 30 when I decided I was a feminist. It was around that time. It was a sort of growing process where I might have said... I might have answered yes to that question if somebody had asked me directly, but I wouldn't go around saying it before I actually being like, okay, this is... I am going to take this on as an identifier.
As an identity. Yeah. Well, I was 46, and thank you, Jill Soloway.
Never too late.
But yeah, so Toby does not identify as a feminist right off the bat. Mm-hmm. I think her, and then has the body of work of looking at porn without judgment.
Which, can I just sort of interrupt you for 1 second? Which, what's interesting to me about that, I don't know much about formalism, but the way she describes her project to Silvaire is that she's looking at pornography as just shapes.
Yeah, shapes and colors.
Shapes and colors. Which is, like, interesting to me because it's, she's trying to do something that is not the male gaze, but is not, I don't think, any kind of feminist gaze either. So she is actually kind of right, maybe, in her own assessment of her project. But it is a kind of like radical desexualization of what's going on in porn. Because it's not at all about the narrative. It's not at all about the agency of the people in it. It is about kind of radically objectifying what's happening on the screen. Because you're not even looking at them as people. You're looking at them as shapes. And I just had that thought just now. And I thought I would say it because I don't really know what's going on with it. But I think it was interesting.
Yeah, I also don't know anything about the arena of knowledge around that. But I found it very interesting. And then I'm interested also in Toby, who deliberately dresses. Like, her skirts are so short that when she walks, they fly up to her waist.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel that I am also interested not in the moment that we're going to talk about, the awful way that... Silvaire puts it, but I'm very fascinated by Toby's choice of studies as well as presentation.
Just how, like, there's a kind of very particular girlish femininity to her.
And then Silvaire's interpretation, which is interesting. Oh, and actually, this is just...
I actually wrote down what he said.
Perfect.
because it's so awful.
But I had noticed that actually Toby... So Dick and Silvaire both will present. They just say these facts. Like, remember Silvaire, when she first met Toby in the first one, was like, which fish will nibble on your feet like this? Like, just this knowledge, imparting this knowledge as if someone doesn't... But then actually she did the same thing. She's like, oh, yes, in ballet. Have you ever been to ballet? So of all the people there, she does present in that similar way of, like, sort of stating these facts.
Yeah.
But then you see Silvaire right away at the party too, kind of be like, oh, hello, young pretty thing. Like, just going up in that totally cliched way, kind of leaning in with the big smile. So it's interesting in a way she, and remember, oh, this is later on. I can't reference that yet. but yeah, I find Toby very interesting because, yeah, again, it's a character I haven't seen a lot of before and, unapologetically wearing skirts super short. And actually that like they're these like flippy skirts. Yeah. That just, you actually see her underwear the whole time. Yeah. And it's really, again, just something I haven't seen a lot of, but with this confidence and this, like, yeah, this is who I am.
Yeah.
Unapologetically.
Yeah.
And yeah, so you see Silvera being like, oh, maybe this is somebody that I might have an affair with, this young little vixen. and then she kind of gets him a little off kilter with sort of, you know, saying the same facts back. Yeah. You've been to Bali. It's beautiful. You should try to go.
Yeah.
And then she doesn't say she's a fellow. And then all of a sudden at the fellows meeting, yes. Dick's like, oh, I didn't know. But like, again, he didn't ask.
Yeah.
But I just find it's sort of a bit of, yeah, you think it's... Or he thinks it's going to be something else. And then I think he's also fascinated and then later on hurt by her.
And then so we keep seeing these moments where he keeps underestimating her. Right? And sort of approaching her in this sort of... That gross way that older men will be both paternal but also sexualizing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? Yeah. And the way in which... So actually that leads into what he says to her in the when they're on their walk. Yeah, he asks about her project and she says that she's analyzing pornography as through its form as like objects and colors. And he just sort of he does this thing where like there's some distance between them. It's like he sort of walks off a little bit and then he sort of spins around, he sighs and he's sort of taking her in and he says He says, you're such a child. You're just so young. I mean, why are you obsessed with porn? Why? My God, look at you. You are so beautiful. So achingly beautiful. Sorry. It's just so, like...
And I think shortly after, before that, as she's talking about her work, he goes, you got a Guggenheim for that? Which is, like, the most insulting way you can present something to somebody.
It's just so terrible. I mean, like, definitely her work doesn't sound like my thing, but like just the way he feels entitled to treat her that way when she's a serious artist.
Yeah It just reminded me again of another moment where they first met, but she kind of vaguely like said something slightly just off-putting, and then she's like, I like how your face is like ruined. So it is interesting. She sort of all the characters, she kind of like dishes it back more than other ones.
Yeah. And so after he says that thing about how she's so achingly beautiful, do you know what? Like, it reminds me a little bit of the Marry the Night example, just in a small way. So I'll explain what we mean by that if you want to talk about it.
Sure. Which example, like, particular?
So when he says this, you're so beautiful, so achingly beautiful, and she stops and she looks at him and she kind of smirks, and then she says, you're awful. It reminded me of when you were the Queen of the Parade.
The moment that Lisa's talking about was I was doing a large-scale art installation called Queen of the Parade for Nuit Blanche, which is a Canadian all-night contemporary art exhibition in Toronto. And I built myself up to be a 26-foot queen with 15-foot video legs. So I was actually up by the streetlights myself, and torso up was me. And then there was basically a building was built as a skirt. And there was large video legs on the front walking to give the illusion of a large woman coming down the street. It was a parade queen, so I had stockings and garters and high heels in the legs. Mm-hmm. And I was wearing a corset on top. So of all the Nuit Blanche that year, there was like one parade of clowns. There was not a lot of sexualized things. But as it got, it gets a boozy event. And I'd say from about 2 a.m. on, it's a very boozy frat boy style of booze fest. Mm-hmm. I was up there, I think it was around 2:30, and a young fellow had climbed up, had like shimmied up one of the poles, and he was almost at my level, actually. Like, it was kind of remarkable. He shimmied up.
Oh my God, I thought he shouted this for you from the. Okay.
He sort of shimmied up. Again, probably not as. I mean, I was 26 feet up, so realistically, but he was like up above, and he drunkenly pointed at my. Again, it was the video of the high heels and stockings and sort of little frilly panties. He goes, I'm going to jerk off to you tonight. Really loud. And again, this was. Because of his height, I guess, too, and his yelling. And without thinking, because it didn't even feel any kind of emotion. It was just, and I pointed, and also I was dressed up like a queen. I felt like the height that I had this beloved status. I was like this lady in the sky. And I just pointed over to him. It was still a bit down. And I said, "You're the third person that said that to me tonight." And in that moment, this was at Queen and University, which is a fairly large intersection in Toronto and one of the hubs of Nuit Blanche that year. We were told that there was 500,000 people over 12 hours at that corner. So just to give, it was like, just people as far as I could see. And everybody sort of in the vicinity around me, as soon as I pointed that and said it to him, it was so dismissive. He turned bright red, slithered back down the pole. Everybody laughed, including his friends who even laughed at him.
Oh my God.
So I felt like, yeah, and I guess he was the third person that's basically said that he was going to jerk off to me. And I was like, anyway, so I felt like it totally took all the wind out of his sails and then made him the object of mockery in a split second without me having any rational thought in there.
Yeah, and so just so you know, listeners, I'm super glad we have this on record now because I will be using this example in my dissertation. It's Wonderbar. In the final chapter, the chapter I have not yet written. But here's what I find amazing about that is that, God, I'm going to ad-lib some stuff about hate speech right now. We often talk in philosophy about slurs and hate speech and the particular kind of reasons and explanations for the harm that they do. So when you, call somebody any kind of slur, but, you know, the ones used for women are often like bitch or slut. But what philosophers, I find, don't talk about enough, although there's been some recent literature on it, is how there are sometimes, in some contexts, with a certain amount of insight and creativity, ways to respond to people that I think do exactly what you did to this guy, which is to deflate, like, the performative speech act.
It actually felt like, you know, I think it's Aikido, that's the martial art where you take someone's movement that they put towards you, like their aggression, and I just felt like I flipped it, like without thinking, and because it actually felt like it was exactly pointed back at him, and then all of his friends took it over.
And so, yeah, that's exactly it. And I think part of, more specifically, what happened was he was in a very, like, masculine, macho, toxic way.
Up a straight line,
up a pole, up a phallic object. he was, like, kind of using you as a way to demonstrate his masculinity.
Seemed like to be cool for his friends. Like, that's kind of what it sort of seemed like.
I mean, I think just, like, in a way, like, sexualizing you was him just, just demonstrating his machismo in a very banal way. And so your comment, so in a way he was, like, trying to reduce you to your gender, but your response did exactly that Aikido move, where you were like, no, I don't reduce to my gender. You reduce to your gender. You are not even the first person to say that shit to me tonight.
Not even the second.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, that really felt like something.
So that will be going in my dissertation because it is amazing.
And yeah, it's funny. I was really super tired and it just happened. I was like, that was just, it just felt so good. Mm-hmm. And I think it is that Aikido move, something that, thrown at me. And I don't feel like it didn't feel hugely malicious. It just felt like silly. Do you know what I mean? Like
this dude.
And I was like, Jesus. But yeah, I just like right off, like ducks off water's back. Like water off a duck's back. It really did that flying back thing. And yeah. Thank you for reminding me of it.
Thank you for doing it. and so when Toby looks at Silvera and smirks and says, "You're awful," and he looks like she has just smacked him.
Yes, it does. He looks like totally deflated.
Like he had, like he was like, "What? I was complimenting you.
You're so beautiful and you're so young. Those are such important things in the world." Yeah. And then it's interesting because after that moment, he goes, and remember, he couldn't read his wife. And I felt like there was this sort of weird aggression in his desire to have sex to, like, morph that moment into something else. But I think it's because he was really devastated by what Toby had said. Because I think he probably presented himself as, like, when he's with the young ladies, he's always, like, benign. He's just this nice guy. He's, like, benign. And then to have it be called out like that, I think it was a real shocker. And he did look like, Griffin Dunn's a really good actor, but he looked, like, literally, like, deflated after that. And also confused. The same, like, Dick, like, does not compute almost. Yeah. Deflated and confused.
Yeah. That's interesting. I had sort of felt very awkward about that, almost, but not quite, sex scene at the end. But I couldn't... I was a bit confused about what was going on with him. But you're absolutely right. It follows on that Toby scene. And I think his attempt at seducing his wife badly was absolutely a reaction to his masculinity feeling deflated. Speaking of which, shall we move into the segment about intimacy and authenticity? Okay. I want to know what you make of the fantasy scene at the beginning of this episode. You've watched this so many times.
I have. Which particular scene?
Where they're fucking and she's imagining Dick watching them. Because it's a bit more, it's not as ugly a scene.
It's true.
The one where they're just in their t-shirts in the previous episode, and you see more of their faces. Like this, you get a lot of close-ups of her tits in this one.
Seems a lot more, yeah, actually sexualized.
Yeah.
I guess this is just, I'm just thinking this sort of for the first time now, but I feel like that's her, because she's really like hot for him. So I feel like it's her fantasy, but again, she's driving it. So it is filmed in a more sexualized way.
Yeah, because it's not just him looking at her, it's her looking at him
yeah. looking at her.
Yeah. Which, okay, so that is similar to the structure of John Berger's description of the nude, but it feels more active.
Yes. Yeah, I guess it was just another active moment of her taking those letters and her obsession, activating it with her own husband. But yeah, I feel like the scene, like, Silver was actually almost not even there. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was, yeah. but oh, he was yeah. like a, he's like a surrogate body between her and Dick. She's watching Dick watching her. But it is, and it's interesting because I remember I said earlier, often I find sex scenes boring. That was clearly not boring, but it was also not as uncomfortable as the other ones.
Yeah.
So I think it's like the evolution of Chris Kraus crafting her sexual story.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting way of thinking about it.
And I just thought that for the first time right now because of your question. Because I guess I'm very fascinated by the intimacy of how this episode, this series and Jill Soloway's shows do show sex so intimately, and often they don't show any sexual, you know, like breasts, or like you don't see much, but you still feel like you're right there. And this felt like it was maybe finding in the female gaze way, a new way to show a sex scene. So you can show some stuff. You don't have to show nothing.
Yeah.
So I just thought of that for the first time too, but that could be just a different way.
Yeah. And I think just, we do get a lot of her face, and it's hard to describe because, yeah, I still feel like some of this is the narrative, sort of like her narrative, rather, figuring itself out. But that there's something active about it, and that there is something kind of like, she's sort of embracing. There's just like a lot of like feeling and noise coming from her. And just like, it's not a focus on Silver. Because I feel like normal quote-unquote sex scenes and romantic comedies, it is about like them having some sort of vague romantic connection and then everyone coming at the same time, and like that is not what was going on here. Like, it was very messy and it was very loud and it was very aggressive,
all about, yeah, and all about her. Yes. And then remember at the end, she just comes into focus. Like, remember, he's actually fully out of focus when she comes, and then she comes into focus. She's got that like Cheshire Cat grin of like, yeah, this worked out.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really not, it's not Silver's scene at all.
Yeah.
So I think that it's like a different, yeah, it's sort of like how the female gaze is 5 minutes old. It's like an early try of like what it might look like if it's not all about Silver. And it's interesting that it was still a little bit all about Dick, but she made it all about Dick.
Yeah. Yeah, I still don't know quite what to make of this, but I am interested in thinking about this as we continue.
Yeah, me too.
Because I kind of feel like this is an early thought, but it feels a bit like she's appropriating his gaze for her own purposes. And I can't quite figure out what it means for her yet. And I still haven't watched past halfway through the penultimate episode. I think it's a penultimate episode where there was a very uncomfortable scene that I keep finding difficult to sit down and watch. But now that my chapters are in, maybe I'll find the courage. But I feel like the way that scene plays out might kind of elucidate this for me. But I mean, I think we will be continuing to talk about this as we move forward.
Definitely. But yeah, I think it almost, the more we're talking about it, it seems like it's like Chris Kraus trying on a sex scene and her version. Like, you know how when I was trying to try on personas, I tried on Ziggy Stardust. She's like kind of trying on Dick's gaze to see how that might feel.
Yeah. Now that we've said it, we gotta get it. Until next time.
Until next time.